Mabuff!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. My apologies in taking so long in getting this episode out. It's the second of two parts, which means I left you on a cliffhanger and then gave you nothing for a month. I had the Melbourne Magic Festival was on again, which meant I ended up doing something like 40 shows. I premiered Deceptology, which is my new show about the neuroscience of magic, which was inspired by episode 12 of this podcast, which was with Stephen Macnick and Susanna Condi Martinez, which is all about the neuroscience of magic and why we get fooled by magic. It was a lot of fun, and I've now been booked to do a few other festivals and shows around Australia, so keep your eye out for dates on that one. I also did the Best of the Magic Fest, which is essentially me hanging out with my magic buddies doing card tricks late at night in a little studio at the back of Northcote Town Hall, and it is my favorite thing in the world to do because magicians often have to put on a character and they need to separate themselves from the audience a little bit and present ourselves as having this extraordinary abilities. But with the Best of the Magic Fest, it's close-up magic and it's relaxed and it's fun and it's silly and it's something you rarely get to do as a magician. So it was an absolute pleasure to do that. There was a lot of extraordinary performers. So some of the international guests came along. John Archer, who's an amazing British comedian and mentalist, was there. And also Nicola Gidley, she's 14. She's got a bunch of stuff on YouTube. Check her out. She's really, really good. She ended up winning the AIM Juniors stage and close-up competition. So close-up magic and stage magic. And she won both of those. So she's an extraordinary magician. She's only 14. So with all of that going on, unfortunately, this episode did fall behind. And in the meantime, I got a lot of feedback from people about this particular episode. I was accused of being in the pocket of Big Alien by some true believers who really believe in the alien autopsy footage. I was also pointed out by a couple of people that Spiros is over-exaggerating his role and other people did a lot of the work that he has taken credit for. But most people just wanted to find out what happened next. So let's do that right now. If you enjoy the podcast, please, please go to iTunes and leave a review. Everyone keeps telling me I should be selling merchandise or setting up a Patreon page, which is not really my style. I might do it, but it's just not me. So what I would really love is if you could go to iTunes, give the show 5 stars, say some nice words, or even just send me an email, because that's what I really love, is getting feedback from you about what you like, what you don't like, and what keeps you listening to Scammapalooza. On with the show. Spiros Malaras knows how to spin a tale. In the first part of our interview, Spiros revealed his role in the 1995 Alien Autopsy video, how he and film producer Ray Santilli teamed up to create an extraordinarily believable 20-minute video that appears to depict an alien being dissected in 1940s Roswell, New Mexico. In part two of our conversation, Spiros talks about the fallout from the video, his falling out with Santilli, and the Easter eggs he hid in the film. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. The version you've told today is one version of what happened, and it is the one that I would most likely believe because it doesn't involve aliens. Whereas Santilli, despite coming out and saying, yes, it was a hoax, his argument, and I may be wrong here, I may be misquoting him, is that he says that original video, the one with the little boy and the paper mache, the one that he showed you, was a real alien autopsy video, but film quality, and so he decided to remake it in order to share it with the world because he couldn't share the real one. Right. Is that what, I mean, obviously we're speaking on his behalf, but is that the story that you know him to tell?
Yeah, you've nearly got it right. Santilli maintains that he had a genuine, real alien autopsy, not the first one, because that was exposed as fake very early on.
And now, when we say, sorry, because there's three videos. There's the paper mache one, which he showed you, and then there's the one that you made with him, and then there is the one that you then had to, that you say you funded to make a third video. So you're saying this is a fourth video before all of those three?
Yes. So what there is two alien autopsies that I made, which are they feature the same body, exactly the same body, but one's got a dog, one hasn't. Okay, the first one was only seen by a select few people and never seen again. Very early on, after I said it was fake, Keith Bateman went public and said that he made it in a farm shed and blah blah blah, and that was exposed immediately. But Santilli's story today is that he reckons, this is what he's saying, he bought an alien autopsy and it became damaged. And only some frames existed. Only some frames survived. And what I did is I made a copy of the original film that's damaged. And there are still some real frames of footage within the film that I made. This is the story that Santilli is putting out today.
Right. So, yeah, on his website it says... in 1995, John sculptured the Roswell alien in 1947.
Yeah.
So now, that's what he says on his official website.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, right, John and Santilli had no contact until after the alien autopsy was made. John worked for me. So I paid John. I instructed John. John worked with me. Santilli was on the other side of the fence and had no input at all. So... to say that John copied frames of original film is only possible if I gave them to him. And all that John ever got from me was sketches that we did together. And we went very carefully as to how many fingers and toes they should have, what the eyes should look like, what should the mouth should look like, should it have teeth, why hasn't it got a navel? I drew... and wrote a story behind this alien so that I knew who the alien was in order to build the body. And the reason it hasn't got a navel, the reason it hasn't got teeth, the reason, all these things, why the ears are set lower, why the big eyes, why the nose, all these things were written into a story. It's in my book, and I've written a very detailed story about who this alien is. And then we made the body. There was never any real film as such because it's fictitious. This is a figment of our imagination. Santilli cannot say that because he sold a number of tapes, which he called Roswell the Footage, which purported to be this film, a real alien, and blah, blah, blah. And all those people paid good money for a film of a real alien. So if suddenly he now says, oh, no, it's all fake, I dare say there would be a class action against him and it becomes fraud and all sorts. He originally argued that I can't be done for fraud because I've never said this is an alien, right? Now, what he did say when he sold the film to Fox in America... you're probably aware of the film that Fox made. Fox made a yep. one-hour special called Alien Autopsy, Fact or Fiction. And it was presented by Jonathan Frakes from Star Trek. And they spent $1 million making that program. When they bought the footage from Santilli, Santilli didn't tell them it's an alien. Santilli said, and here's the important part where I'm coming from. Santilli said, I don't know what it is. You tell me. He didn't say it's an alien. He said, I don't know if it's an alien. I don't know what it is. You tell me. Take it away. Investigate it. Tell me what it is. Now, he thinks he's covered by saying that because he hasn't said it's an alien. Well, actually, he's not covered because he didn't know what it was. So he can't say, I don't know what it is. Tell me. Because he knew very well what it was. So that argument I don't think would stand. Earlier on I said to you, I'd love a day in court with Santilli because no matter what Santilli says, his argument will fall down if it was in court, because I only need to ask him three or four questions in a row and he won't be able to answer them. You know, if there was a damaged film, where is it? Show us the damaged film. Okay? Question number one. And he'll say, oh, I don't have it anymore. Why would you dispose of it? Why wouldn't you keep it in a glass case? It's damaged, but you know what? It's real. It's priceless. Even if it's deteriorated, even if it's become dust, it's real. But let's just leave that to the side for a moment. Let's now go to the next part of his question, his story. There are real, genuine frames within the film that he released. Well, in that case, there must have been an editor. There must have been somebody who edited the film that I supposedly made and the film that he supposedly had. Okay? So when you add those two together, there must be someone out there, if not Santilli, because he's been asked the question, he said, I don't know, I don't remember. Which of the frames are real? I don't know, I don't remember. That's really silly. I don't remember. But but an editor would know immediately. If you asked me, I could tell you any edit, any frame, I could tell you, because I've lived it. I've lived it in detail. So an editor. So the only editor that worked on that film is me. That's the truth, the reality. But from Santilli's story, there must be another editor. Because if I'm telling you I didn't edit real clips, real frames within that film, then somebody must have, if Santilli's story is true. So can we speak to this editor, please? And he'll say, oh, well, I don't know where he is. I don't know who he is. I don't know where he died. I don't know what happened to him. That's going to be the story. So in the absence of real frames within my film, and that you can show us where they are, because I touched on it earlier on, the autopsy table is not real, and that can be proven that it's not real, okay? And the suits can be proven they're not real. So if the suits are not real and the table's not real, then just by elimination and elimination alone, if you get rid of every frame that's got the suits or the table in them, it only leaves you a little bit of film, however good you are.
The problem that we have, obviously, is now we have a conspiracy within the conspiracy.
That's right. And a
hoaxes within hoaxes and lies on top of lies. And Ray Santilli's name is obviously because he is the person who was out there selling it and distributing it, and who sort of came up with the initial concept and which you obviously ran with. But he's the one whose name is in the history books, and your name is only coming up now, sort of, you know, in the later stages, because of obviously the fact that he's you know, executive producer of the 2006 film, and he's the one who's really pushed it. Who can back up your version of events? Like, who have you got in your court who can say, yep, that's what happened?
Well, I've got a couple of little bits and pieces that I'm keeping back for my film, but my business partner at the time is in the debris footage as a soldier, and he's coming forward at about September when my book's released. Also, John Humphreys, at the moment, is towing the company line because Santilli paid him. But the problem that John has is that he can't maintain the story because it falls down. And once you start scratching the surface, it falls down because Santilli's story has not been very well thought out. So, slowly, what's happening is I'm scratching away now at little bits. For example, YouTube. I've gone to YouTube and I've claimed the copyright to the film. And
ooh, Santilli, that is a big deal in 2016 to claim copyright of a YouTube video is a major claim to make.
It's a big deal. And YouTube are listening to me, thank God, because they could very easily just leave it as it is, because Santilli has a Wikipedia page that he maintains. So I've gone in and changed the Wikipedia page and they just change it straight back. And that's going to need a court case to correct, which I will do. But more importantly, though, with Santilli's response to YouTube was he holds the copyright because he registered it at the Chamber of Commerce in America. And what he did was, or whatever the library's called, it's a copyright library. So I contacted them. I went online and I checked it out. And what Santilli did was he registered the Alien Autopsy film. He said date of creation, 1947. And then he said cameraman, unknown. And then he put the copyright owner as his company, Orbital Media. So I've called them up and I've said, I'm the cameraman. It wasn't made in 1947. It was made in 1995. And can you please tell me what the procedure is for me to contest the entry? And they said, well, there's no procedure to contest the entry, but you can enter, you can create an entry yourself. All you have to do is just pay a fee. So all of a sudden, it becomes a very, very wishy-washy copyright, if anything, because I've now been allowed to issue a copyright of that film and creation 1995 with my name on it. And the only thing that I need to do is pay a fee. So that's the value of his copyright. It has no value. It's not.
Will he admit you had any role in the film? I mean, will he publicly say
he has admitted over the years? First denied I had anything to do with it at all, and then he had to admit that I had something to do with it because, unbeknown to me, and it wasn't deliberate at all. You know, it just happened. I unwittingly somehow kept back the camera original footage of the debris footage. So I still have the camera footage from the debris footage before I aged it. So I've got brand new, lovely, crispy, clean, clear footage that Santilli released as wishy-washy, black and white, grey, and you know, aged. So how I've got clean, amazing quality footage of the same footage, the only answer to that is, of course, that I had something to do with it. So Santilli, if Santilli was in front of me in that line, he would have the clean footage too. But he doesn't have it. So I've been able to show footage that Santilli doesn't have. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I filmed an interview with who was supposed to be the original cameraman. All right, I went to Los Angeles with Gary Shewfield, and I said to him, look, Hong Kong TV needed an interview with the cameraman. They wanted to buy the footage. They wanted to have an interview with the cameraman. Santilli would always maintain the cameraman wanted to stay anonymous. And they said, well, this is part of the deal. If we can't have the cameraman, we're not buying the footage. So he said, well, what if I gave you an interview of the cameraman in silhouette? And he'll answer whatever questions you want. So they went with that. So Santilli then called me and said, oh, I've got a big problem. I've got to create this bit of film of the cameraman. What should we do? And I said to him, Ray, I'll tell you what. We go to America. We find a bum in the street. And we make him up and we film him to be the cameraman. And because he's somebody homeless, he's not going to have television, so he's not going to be able to see the interview at any time. If he's the right age, he's not going to live very long. So it's the best bet we've got. And Santilli said, I don't think it'll work. I don't think it'll... And I said, look, I can make it good. Let me just do that. So he said, okay, what do you want to do? I said, I'm going to go to Los Angeles. I'm going to find somebody in the street. I'm going to just film it. So he said, all right, Gary will meet you there. So Gary went to LA via New York because they didn't want anything at all to say that we flew together to LA at a particular time. So that's how secretive it was all kept. So we went to LA. We found this old boy who was 80-something. And I just went up to him and said, look, we're making a student movie. We want you to be a part in it. Would you mind doing a little bit of filming with us? And I said, we're going to film in a hotel somewhere. You can stay the night in the hotel and you can eat and drink and have a bath and do whatever you want to do. And we'll give you $500. So the guy agreed. And we found a hotel room. And I did a load of makeup on him. And Gary went off to get coffees and what have you. And I'm the only one who knows who the guy is. I'm the only one who knows who the actor. He was an out-of-work actor. And we had a long, long chat. And I know a movie he was in that I've bought. And so I can prove who the guy is. So Santilli gave that movie to Hong Kong as if it was the cameraman. So that's also coming out in my book. There's lots and lots of different things that I've done that Santilli can't argue that I was involved. You mentioned the I-beams earlier on. One of them said freedom. Remember the I-beam you mentioned?
Yeah. Yeah, it flip-flops in Greek.
Yeah, I made all those items with John, and the language that's on the beams is a language that I made up. So it's Greek stylized Egyptian with English meaning. So you could actually see within that you can see the English alphabet, but very very stylized. If you look at the beam, that one beam. It says Eleftheria, which means freedom in Greek. But if you turn that beam upside down, the same letters read video. And the reason that was done that way, that's actually, you know, there's a lot of things, the allied arts of magic, you know, like puzzles and...
ambigrams, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and all that sort of stuff. It's that they're all allied arts. And that's one of the things, turning a word upside down to read another word is a big giveaway. But the idea here was most people who are not educated to this would think the word video is a modern word. Video is a modern thing, video. You know, you had film, then you had video. But that's how somebody who doesn't know would think. And that stinks of hoax. But the initiated would know that video is Latin. So it's an ancient word. So it would then go back again to, oh, okay, it still can be old, you know, in a modern context. So... Yeah. I know what there's another I-beam and it's got a word on it and I know what that says, and once I tell you what it says you'd be able to see it too immediately if you could speak Greek. It's in my book again, as I say, there's lots of things that are not obvious, but once you know it all starts to make sense that this isn't. You're familiar with the control panels in the debris footage?
Yeah, they look like large baking trays with handprints, kind of six-fingered handprints. Yeah.
Yeah. Now there's actually a sketch in my book of the spacecraft of where they would fit, how they would be used, but much more basic than that. They actually serve as an optical illusion, and it's a very well-known magic illusion. And it's in books, you know, it's been published, you know, throughout the years as a magic illusion. So once you see the two things side by side, you will go, oh, God, yes, I see that now. Where people just don't know. And the reason I put all this stuff like this is so I can show you the depth, and... only someone in the know would know, and
Can you name? Are you happy to name the magic illusion that you're referring to?
I will. You know what? I haven't told anybody up till now. You're the first person. If you look through puzzle books and through some magical illusion books, you will see there's if you draw a shape which is like the panels, the control panels, which is a circle, like, you know, a curve, which is longer than the inner curve, okay? When you place one on top of the other, one looks bigger than the other one. But if you place it on top of each other, they're the same size.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah, I know the one. Yep.
Okay.
A lot of people do it these days with Starbucks cup warmers. You take off the cup warmer, and it's the Mueller illusion, I think it's called.
That's it. Like that. So if you place one on top of the other, it looks like the one beneath is not the same size as one on top, but they actually are. Mm. Now look at the debris footage, and you will actually see Greg, who's my partner that will come, is going public in September. Actually, I directed him to pick one up. They're laid in the right position on the table. And he picks one up and brings it forward. And it shows you that they now look the same size. And then puts them back. And it now looks like the one on top is bigger than the one on the bottom. It's exactly right.
Yeah, exactly. I'm actually watching it right now. Yeah, okay. He like picks them up and he puts them back down again. Okay. Yeah.
Now, if you find the right magic book or the right puzzle book, you will see the drawing of that illusion is exactly those two panels, one on top of the other. It's what's called That's taking great. The piss. I was taking the piss.
Brilliant.
But it's so That's well fantastic. Hidden.
It's yeah, so well, that's not the sort of thing. Yeah, it's such a subtle, thing. A lot of what is in here is, it reminds me in the video that the secret hidden language, the little piss takes, the science fiction of it and the aliens and so on. It reminds me a lot of Futurama, that sort of love of science, but also that love of Easter eggs and being able to look and rewatch and see it over and over and over again. And I guess that's why the footage it has survived as long as it has, is that it does stand up to multiple viewings. Every time you watch it, there's something new to find and new to see hidden there.
If you look at the autopsy table, for example, it has drain holes. And if you now look beneath the table itself, you will see there's a tray which collects blood that goes down through the drain holes into the tray. The table worked. What I'm saying is it wasn't just a prop. It actually worked as an autopsy table. The level of detail was, you know, it was unsurpassed because it was just as easy to make it that complex as to just make it as a prop. You know, when you're making a film set, you know, walls are thin and flimsy. You know, things don't have to be what they are in real life. They just need to look like what they look like, you know. But in the alien autopsy, everything is as it's purporting to be. You know, the electrical outlet that I told you about, the Bakelite outlet, I actually bought four of those because I found four. And I just place them in the room. And I think two of them you don't get to see ever. But they were there nonetheless, and they were wired up. And I could have plugged anything into them, and they would work. And the reason I did that is I had the freedom, if I needed to do that, if I needed to plug something into the wall, because it was as easy to do as not to. You know, I had a transformer that gave me 110 volts, and all I had to do was to come out of that transformer into one socket and then just create a ring all the way around to all the others. So it wasn't a big deal. And at the time, John would say, well, why are you wiring up that socket when it's not going to be used? You know, and my argument was, I might use it. I don't know, I might use it. And while I'm doing it, it's literally another 10 minutes. I may as well just do it. And so behind those walls, things were plumbed in, things were wired in, things were, you know, everything was there. So it's because of that detail that if your field of expertise is the clock, then you're looking at everything about that clock. You're not looking at an alien. The alien happens to be there, but if that clock was a 1965 clock, that alien is not real, full stop. Everything, you throw everything out. So everything had to be right, because if your expertise is the telephone, if your expertise is the Bunsen burner, if that is wrong, everything is wrong. So it had to be right. You'll see that the surgeon, the nurse, is writing something down on a pad. She's holding a pencil, because I didn't know what pen they would have at that time. I didn't know whether a Bic pen was how far back it went. We couldn't establish what a pen looked like in that environment. So we had to go with a plain pencil so that it couldn't
just
be dated.
Just to be on the safe side.
Yeah, so it couldn't be dated. And the pencil that we used is just a wooden pencil. No printing, no nothing.
What then do you think is the legacy of the alien autopsy video? Because I would argue that it kicked off the new generation of hoax videos and prank videos of films like, you know, found footage movies like The Blair Witch Project. I think, you know, The Blair Witch Project was made, they started to make it around the same time as this, and you can see the influence of that movie on this one. Do you think that there is that massive sort of cultural impact that this one little film has had?
I think it did grasp the imagination of a lot of people, and I think that, and that's quite evident. I mean, I've got so much material that I've collected over the years, which are remakes and remakes and remakes of my film, again and again and again. I mean, it's just, there's a film made by a guy called Nabil Shabam, who, he, interestingly, played a monster in the original Doctor Who series that John Humphreys sculpted. And it was a monster called Syl, and he had a maggot tail. And Nabil, the actual guy, he's handicapped and is wheelchair bound. But John had to put on a prosthetic maggot tail and make him all up, you know. And it's quite a ghastly little thing, you know, in Doctor Who.
It is, yeah, I remember. It's a little greeny and, gold creature with kind of odd, it looks like he's wearing a sort of a helmet with fish fins on top. And it looks like a cross between a Fiji mermaid and a maggot.
Yeah. Now,
hint of Jabba the Hutt in
there
too.
Exactly right. I'm pleased you know that. I'm pleased you know it.
So, oh, I know my Doctor Who.
Okay, so imagine this, okay? John Humphreys was making the effects for the Doctor Who series, and he made that. And the guy that's in that suit, all these years later, then makes an alien autopsy spoof. So if you were to do a search for Nabil, I think it's Nabil, Shabam, is it Shamb? I can send you it separately.
Great. Yeah, that's fine. We'll put a link on the website.
I'll try and find the link for his film. But he plays the alien. So there's an alien autopsy, very stylized, just like my film. And he's the alien, and he actually jumps up from the table and starts singing. And it's actually quite funny. But you know, that's actually quite funny, because it's done a full circle. You know, the link between John and he, and then the alien autopsy is actually quite funny that he didn't know that John had been on it. You know, because he had no idea it was a hoax at that time. It was just a film that was released, and he was just going along with the culture, with the pop culture. And there's quite a lot of that sort of thing. Frank Skinner here, a comedian here, he did a whole spoof on the alien autopsy. And then there was a number of sculptures and toys and all sorts. So yes, it did grab the imagination for sure. I don't know where it's going to end. I mean, after my book, it's going to be quite a lot of very fine detail.
It sounds to me like as we've talked, it sounds like you're clearly passionate about the truth getting out there, so to speak, of getting your story out there. But it also sounds like you do feel like once your book comes out, that you'll be able to say, you know, that this will be a definitive proof and people will be able to put it to rest. But every few years, there seems to be a new, you know, something else will come out about this video and some other, you know, perspective, or someone else has something to say that brings it either closer to the truth or further away from the truth. So I'm not 100% sure that it ever will completely go away.
Well, you know what? I'm going to try and do my best to create enough, put enough stuff out there to put it to bed once and for all. But one thing that was suggested, there's I'm a member of a group on Facebook. It's about 600 UFO fanatics that are on there, and it's actually an alien autopsy list. So that's what they're there for. They're there to discuss the film, and it's a cross mix of people that believe it's real and those that now believe it's fake, and those that always thought it was fake. You know, there's a good cross of people there. And the most recent discussion was, would I be prepared to take a lie detector test? And I said to them, well, I would take a lie detector test, but there's one underlying problem, which is people will always say, oh, but you're a magician and somehow you've faked it or you've beaten it.
Also, lie detectors are notoriously... Yeah, lie detectors are the alien autopsy footage of psychology. You know, you can use it to prove someone's a liar, or you can then just turn around and say, oh, but they don't work anyway. So
yeah, but there's one of the guys there said, well, there's actually three different lie detector tests that you can take, and you can't beat them all, because one of them measures sweat. The other one measures brain activity, and another one measures heart rate and pulse rate.
Yeah, so, and none of them are 100% though. None of them. So even if you did manage to, even if there's absolutely no way for you as a magician to cheat on them, there's also no way for them to. There's no way for them to ever prove that they work. Like no one's ever proved that they work.
My answer was, you know what? Their argument was that if you were to cheat three different tests like that, it would be phenomenal. And I said, well, look, I'm quite happy to take the tests regardless, but on one condition. Well, two conditions, actually. The first condition is that Santilli is invited to take the test as well. I'm not saying he has to take the test, because he won't take it. It's a given. He will not take, you know, there's no way that he's going to take a lie detector test, full stop. But I want it on record that he was asked to. And I will do it, but he won't. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if I am shown not to be lying, then I own the footage and the results of that test to use as I wish. If I'm lying, they own the film and the results, so they can then do what they like with them. Because I'd have it filmed, of course. So I'd take the test and film the whole thing. But if I'm telling the truth, I want to own it. And if I'm not telling the truth, that's the film that you'd want to own, isn't it?
It is, but you know what? Like I hear that kind of challenge or those sort of conditions laid down a lot, where someone goes, yes, I will do the test, but only if. And I understand where you're coming from, in that you know that you don't want to just do a lie detector test, which as I already said, I think are bullshit. But you also don't want to, you want to get something out of it. But at the same time, as soon as you start adding on those sort of ultimatums or that sort of criteria, that then, I guess, creates doubt in the minds of people that you're doing for, and they start questioning your motives, because rather than being seeking the truth, it then becomes about you seeking, get, you know, as you said, getting the rights to the footage, which is a completely different issue. So, I mean, it's those sort of challenges, you know, and it's the same sort of challenges you get. You often hear psychics will say, you know, well, I'll, you know, yes, I'll agree to your test, but only, you know, if, and then they start adding in extra information. So I mean, to me, I think those kind of challenges, and those sort of tests, they come across as more about, not publicity stunts, but they do come across as more stunt-like than truly seeking the truth.
Yeah, the truth must always come out. But the reality is this. One, I'm a showman. Two, I'm a producer. And if this material is going to be created, I've just learnt my lesson, you know. I want to own it, because I then want to be able to exploit it for me, not for anyone else. Because the fact is, if I'm genuinely telling the truth and I pass the test, but then that footage is no good to anybody who's skeptical, because they can't use the footage if it says I'm not lying. The only time they would want that film is if I'm lying and it says I'm lying. So, and I'm saying, if I'm lying and it comes out that I'm lying, you can have the film. So that's the time you'd want to own it, because then you'd want to bury me, wouldn't you? So,
fair enough.
You with me? So I'm happy for you to have it if I'm lying. But equally, I don't want you to prosper when I'm telling the truth, because this group basically, they've been very verbal, very personal, very nasty. And that's why I wouldn't want them to have the film. If it's, as I say, if I'm right, then why am I rewarding them for disbelieving me? That I don't want to play that. So, but the point I was making was, I'm happy to take the test, no matter what the test is. Santilli isn't happy. Santilli will not take that test, because I know he can't. The other thing that I've also been asked to do, which I quite like the idea of, is I've been asked to recreate the AA footage again from scratch and have a crew filming me whilst I'm creating it. So, for example, I'd be left alone in a room and I'd build the autopsy table and I'd build the set and I'd put it all together the same way that I did before. We would make the outfits the same way we did them before, and the whole thing would be filmed. So if you can imagine a time-lapse camera filming me over a period of a day, building the autopsy table, and then there it is. That would give an awful lot of credence to what I'm saying, because the way I built it is a specific way, and you would only be able to rebuild it had you built it once. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So to be able to just dive in and take a sheet of metal and a load of wood and just knock it up and it be the table that's in the film. And same applies to the suits that we're wearing. The same applies to the debris footage, how we made the debris footage and all that sort of stuff. It's specific. There are specific things we did, and you would be able to see immediately this is the person that made them, because you'd see that it isn't obvious when you first look at the debris footage, for example. It's not obvious how the stuff is made. For example, it looks like it's metal, and it looks like the letters are raised, and they're embossed on the metal, and it looks like they're a solid piece. But I won't expose you now. But it isn't what you see. Isn't actually what it is. And when you see how it was made, you'd actually go, oh God, really? How did I not see that? And that's you know, and that's, I think, the crux of the matter is, if I can replicate that film, you know, to the finer detail, it would cement it once and for all. And I'd actually do it for nothing, you know. I'd do it for the cost of the bits, because again, I'd rather co-produce that with somebody, with a TV channel somewhere, and have the explanations. But this will happen, I think, after my book's released, because the book will expose a number of things, and that'll create, I think it will create another surge of interest. The whole UFO community is gagging to buy this book, and it's taken me 21 years to write it. So, you know, and it's there now. And I just finished a 1-hour TV interview with Sky TV. They're doing a series on the world's greatest hoaxes, and there's a 1-hour dedicated to the alien autopsy. So I've just completed that, and that's coming out in September. So I'm going to release my book to coincide with that documentary. And
what will the book, just so people can know if they want to get their hands on it, what will the book be called?
You know what? I started calling it all sorts of things, and then found other people had written books with the same name. Like,
there are a lot of books on
Alien Autopsy, the True Story. Somebody else has written or titled a video by that. One of my friends, Ian Rowland, suggested that I call it the greatest hoax of our millennium. I don't particularly like that.
No, I don't like the word millennium.
That's, no, yeah. I don't think
it's right. Ian Roland, this is Ian Roland, the mentalist who wrote the fantastic book on cold reading. That's right.
Same Ian?
Yeah.
Ian and I are good friends, and he's you know, among most of my magic friends, you know, they're all enthralled by the alien autopsy, because it's just such a cheeky story. But you know, to tell the story in the detail that I need to tell it in, it's quite a concise book, full of plans of how the set was built, how it was wired, how all the finer details, the makeup of the language used on the debris, how that came about, how it's made up, why it reads freedom, and all those bits and pieces, what the other I-beam reads. It's just full of lots and lots of hidden detail, and I think it's good reading. It'll make a great book for somebody to have in their collection. But more importantly, for me, my objective now is to retain my copyright and make sure that the history books are written properly, you know, because at the moment Santilli's written me out of the story completely. He's having to rewrite me back in little by little, but it's not enough. You know, it needs to be the true story. It needs to be exactly how it is. You can't rewrite history. History is history. You know, do you know Omid Jalili? Are you familiar with the name?
No, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Okay, Omid Jalili is a Iranian comedian.
Oh, yeah. Iranian-British comedian, yeah.
Yes. Now, he played me in the Anton Deck film. Okay? Now, my...
By a different name, though. With your name or with a different name?
Well, no, the
name.
Way that they did it was Volker Spielberg was rewritten as Vorosh. So, Vorosh is Volker. And Spiros Melaris is Melik. So Melik is me, Melaris Melik, Vorosh Volker. So they've basically played around with the names, but they've made it quite funny because it's Santilli's sense of humour. He made Volker is very what's the word? Let's just say he's very he has a very strong opinion about things. Like, he doesn't like gays, he doesn't like black people, he doesn't like Jews. I won't say the horrible word, but he's the nicest guy in the world to meet, but that's what he's like. So, you know, if he walks into a restaurant and there's a black man in it, he'll walk out. He's terrible like that. Okay, so Vorosh in the Anton Deck film is gay, and he's got a black boyfriend. Okay, so you can see where Santini is going with it. And Melick, the guy who plays the guy who filmed the alien autopsy, he's basically me. He's Turkish, where I'm Greek.
Yeah.
So he thought that would upset me to make me Turkish. Plus the guy owned a kebab shop. So that he thought that was a nice dig as well, you know, that I would be a kebab shop owner. And the only thing that qualifies this guy to film the alien autopsy is that he does weddings on the weekend. So he's managed to insult me on as many levels as possible. Actually, I'm not.
That's pretty funny. That's pretty funny for a comedy.
It is funny. It's just how Santilli is. So
yeah.
You know, he didn't offend me at all. You know, I'm not.
I guess also they are. I mean, you know, a magician and filmmaker is less funny to put into a comedy than a kebab shop owner who makes wedding videos on the weekend. They were making a movie, which I guess is the point. You were also, you know, making a movie, telling a story, and that's it's all about the details.
John Humphreys is the most talented man I know. I mean, seriously. I mean, he'll pick up a bit of clay and bang, 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 and it looks like a person. I mean, it's just the man is super, super, super talented. And in the Anton Deck movie, he's a mannequin maker. You know, it's just totally belittling because, you know, from being, you know, a Royal Academy artist, it's a mannequin maker, you know. So everything was dumbed down. It became the Gary and Ray show. You know, it was, and I think that's why it lost a lot of meat. You know, there was things that happened in the real life story, which were hilarious, that, you know, properly funny, but they weren't to know that. They just didn't know. You know, when we made the first autopsy, the one with the good leg, okay?
Yep.
The body was on the table, and we filmed the whole thing, cut it all open. There was blood and guts everywhere. It looked terrible. But because we were filming and it was something we saw all day long, we became numb to it. We couldn't really see it, what it really looked like, right? It was very late in the day when we finished. So I said to the guys, let's leave it. Let's go home, get some sleep, and we'll come back the next day and clean up, you know, tidy everything up and clean everything down. So we left the body on the table in the house. Imagine this, okay? A house with three floors, all one big house, but it was going to be made into apartments. But it was all derelict and torn to pieces and just ready to be made into flats. And we were in the middle floor. So at the night time when we left, every time we left the building, we would switch the power supply off downstairs. Okay, so the whole house was dark. There was no electric. You have to switch it on the main fuse and then the whole house lit up. So we switched it off and we left. We went home. That night, there was a burglary. Somebody kicked the door in and went into the house looking for stuff to steal. So I'm guessing they must have had a torch because there was no electric in the house. So can you imagine? This guy has gone upstairs, opened the door, swung round the door with a torch and seen this dead body. Cut guts and stuff. It looked like a murder scene, but we didn't think of it like that because, as I say, we were numb to it. We were working all day. We knew it wasn't real. It wasn't nearly as frightening as had you walked in on it like that. Could you imagine? Right. So there's someone out there who's broken into the house, gone upstairs, seen the dead body, and never told anyone. Right. So. Now that to me is priceless. It actually happened, right? I mean, I filled in the blanks that somebody might have a torch. I'm filled in the blanks because it makes sense. If they kicked the door in and they've gone into a darkened house, how are they seeing? They must have a torch because the power was off in the basement. So, and we know that they went upstairs because the door was open where we closed it. So they must have gone in, completely crapped themselves, and run for dear life, panicked, got outside, and now have got the dilemma. What do they do? Do they call the police? Or do they just leave it? Because if they call the police, well, I broke into this house and I found this dead body. It's something you're not going to do if you're a burglar. So it tickles me that there's someone out there who actually thinks they walked in on some major crime scene. And I don't think they'd know it was the alien autopsy because it didn't look like, you know, once we'd finished with it, you know, everything was different. It was all cut to pieces. It was all, so unless you stuck around, you wouldn't have seen much detail apart from it had two legs, two arms, and it was cut open. There was blood everywhere. So that, to me, is a funny scene to put in a movie. But Santilli wasn't party to it, so he didn't know about it, didn't know to tell the scriptwriters, so that was missed out. And there's a lot of stories like that happened that weren't included. So I think they missed a trick. You know, it could have been a really good movie. Yeah. You know, it just turned into a piece of bubble gum. It was a bit of, you know, light watching, you know.
Or maybe you'll turn your book into, will be turned into a film.
Well, you know what? It's not a script, but it could easily be written into a film, but I'm not sure if the appetite is there for it, you know. The reason that the book hasn't been published all this time is because I really haven't believed there's been an audience for it, you know. If you count up the amount of people that would buy this book, it's not enough to make it viable, you know. And, yeah, you know, and I'm just being realistic. And now it's even worse because 21 years later, there's an awful lot of people walking around right now who weren't even born when the alien autopsy was fresh. In fact, if they were 5 or 6 years old, you know, they're walking around now, they're nearly 30 years old. So those people will still have to be initiated. Well, what is this? What was it about? The ones that know about it, it's so long ago that if you're not in the UFO scene, it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't much to hang on to. The people that are hanging on to it are in the scene, you know, and it was the smoking gun for them. It was look, the government's keeping back, you know, they know there are aliens and they're not telling us and they're not showing us, and, you know, and it's the smoking gun, and they can't allow me to tell them it's not real because it's all they got. And it's a shame, but I think it's, the truth has to be where it's at. It has to be the end.
This has been Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au.